Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined once again by Brad C. Hodson. Today we are talking all about Blaze, which is technically written under the Richard Bachman name, but as many people know now, Richard Bachman is Stephen King, so that is why we are discussing it. Brad, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, of course. I have been very excited to have a bunch of new guests on. And, you know, I'm trying to make it to where everyone gets at least one episode here because I should have asked for new guests much sooner into my run.
Well, you know, you live, you learn.
Yeah. Not saying I don't love talking to my other friends who I talked to for roughly the first 100 episodes.
Well, I had a blast on the last one, and I'm really looking forward to digging into this one. So thanks again.
Yeah, of course. And why don't we go ahead and just dive right in? Because this is a story that, one, isn't super long, and two, doesn't have too many characters. You're really focused on two or three characters the entire story. And I really like that because some of King's longer books, like It, for instance, has this entire ensemble cast and two timelines going on. So he definitely can make it to where things get a little hectic in his books. But I felt like this was something that was very straightforward.
Yeah, it was very simple and focused, which really allowed you to sink into this character of Blaze, Clayton Blaisdell Jr., and really get into his head and be with him for the whole ride. In a way, that simplicity kind of upped the stakes a bit.
Yeah, because when I read the back of this book and it's like, you know, this guy is 6'7", 300 pounds, it immediately gives you an idea of who you're visualizing throughout the story. And Clay is the name of that character, and he meets another character named George. And I really felt like this was one of those kinds of stories where it's just about how reliant one person can become on another.
Yeah, and especially for Clay, when we're seeing his life story, when we cut back to those sections of him as a child growing up in the Hetton home, Hell House, they called it. Mm-hmm. And how kind of his life was just a series of finding people he could rely on only to lose them, which really kind of sets up the motivation for why he even goes through with this crazy scheme to begin with.
Yeah. And it really is crazy when you think about it, because as I was reading this and, you know, I blew through this one pretty quickly. I think it was maybe two or three sittings and I was done with it because it wasn't something that required as much attention to detail, like something like The Dark Tower, for instance. It was just a very intimate story in a sense.
Yeah, with nothing but forward momentum.
Right.
Every time we're in the present, we're constantly moving along this one simple path. And then going back to the past is still moving along a very simple path, just filling out the character. So there's not several plot lines to juggle. There's not subplots. There's not worrying about what this character's motivation is. We're all just on this one simple path that makes it an easy read. It reminded me a bit, and it's funny because I know he's a fan of Elmore Leonard, but in the preface to the version I have, where he's talking about the crime novels that inspired him to write this, he doesn't mention Elmore Leonard a lot, but I definitely felt Leonard's DNA in this a bit. There was just a lot of little moments. And that was something Elmore Leonard was good at too, was that simplicity and getting into a character and just writing a very short but powerful journey with them.
Yeah, and the title of the book comes from Clay's last name, which is Blaisdell, I'm guessing. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but he gets the nickname Blaze from that, basically. And I really thought that all of the interactions between Clay and George, both when they kind of go back and let us know how these two characters met, and then in the present day, and, you know, the big spoiler here, I guess, is that George is maybe dead, but it's not really clear right from the start.
Yeah, and even once it clears up a little bit, there's little instances. I feel like the book very much takes the point of view that the George we see in the present is in Blaze's head, But there are a couple of moments where there's this question of, wait, is it a ghost? Like, I remember one in particular, George is talking to him through from the bathroom, and he has the door cracked open, and Blaze thinks, oh, that's what George always did. But wait a minute, I shut the door when I came out of the bathroom last. Why is it cracked open? And then it just goes on without mentioning it. And so it's like, what's really, what's going on? Is there an element of supernatural? Which, of course, because it's King, you think that. If it was another writer, I might not assume that from these little things. I might think it's just unreliable point of view for Blaze. But it does just leave like a couple of moments of questioning it throughout.
Yeah, plus you have the fact that Blaze obviously isn't the most intelligent person out there, because I don't want to say that everyone knows how to take care of a baby, because I definitely do not think that is the case. But he has this plan with George. And, you know, when we, quote unquote, see George, he's always like, but how are you going to do this? How are you going to do that? He's like the voice of reason the entire time, even though he is definitely pulling cons.
Yeah. Well, in the preface to the edition I have, King says that it's, you know, there's definitely some inspiration of from Mice and Men in this. Obviously, with the character even being named George, you get that. But it's definitely a George and Lenny type of relationship that Blaze, left to his own devices, really can't make it too far. And so he needs someone else. And he recognizes that so strongly that even when George is gone, George stays with him to guide him. And it's almost like Blaze, he can't ask himself these questions. He can't think through the problems, but a part of his mind is able to do it in the guise of George. You know, that it's there in his subconscious, but even in his own mind, he recognizes, well, I can't do that, so it's got to be George.
And at least that's somewhat self-aware enough for him to sort of get by.
Yeah, which was an interesting thing, too. You know, I feel like we've seen, especially in movies over the last 20 years, the kind of twist that pops up frequently where it's like, oh, that character that you thought was around has actually been dead the whole time. And it's interesting in this that Blaze is aware of it. At no point does Blaze think George is alive. And he's even aware at several points that George is him. Like when George is creepily saying, hey, leave the baby, go do what you need to do, I'll take care of the baby.
Uh-huh.
And Blaze is like, well, I don't want to leave George with the baby. That really bothers me. And then he thinks about it more and he's like, well, wait, George is me. If I leave, George leaves. And so it was kind of interesting. Like at no point did you feel like King was trying to play any kind of, you know, clever game where he would pull the rug out from you and be like, here's what's really going on with George. It was just a very matter of fact thing for both the character and the book.
Yeah. And I really liked how Clay played off of George, even though we know that George wasn't really there.
Yeah. They had such an interesting dynamic.
Yeah. Because you have these two sort of opposites, and George is the one reasoning everything out, and he's like, you can leave the baby for, you know, a few seconds, like to go to the bathroom or whatever, you know, those weren't the exact words, but it felt like without George, Clay would have been not necessarily completely lost, but there were moments where he was essentially crying out for George because he didn't know what to do next. And I thought those were some really powerful moments in the story.
Yeah, especially when you get his background and you start learning what happened with his father and what happened when he had been shuttled off to Hell House. It was very sad. Like here was this person who wanted to do good things. He wanted to be a good person and he needed guidance. And unfortunately, the only guidance he ever got was from people like George, who, well, yeah, they were going to take care of Blaze. Like you get the idea that George actually cared about Blaze, but at the same time, George wasn't a good man and was using Blaze to help him do these cons and schemes and whatnot. It's kind of fascinating because Blaze is also a type of character that pops up in other Stephen King stories. You know, he's very much like, oh, I'm blanking on the character's name, the big guy in the stand that travels around with Nick Andros.
Oh, M-O-O-N?
Yeah, yeah. M-O-O-N. Very much like him or like John Coffey in The Green Mile. These large men that aren't very intelligent, but they have such big hearts and are having problems navigating the world and need someone else to help them.
Tom Cullen.
Yeah, yeah, Tom Cullen. That's it.
I had to look it up because I was like, this is going to bother me. I know his yeah. name, and I know he likes to spell moon.
It's interesting. Like, it makes me wonder if King, maybe when he was a kid, met someone like that, that kind of stuck with him. And so he kept revisiting that character.
Yeah, because you do have certain types of characters who will repeatedly appear in King's stories. So it really feels like he's sort of pulling from either a combination of people he knew or things like that. Because, you know, with his accident, when that happened, he pulled that and used it in Kingdom Hospital. You know, that scene is what I imagine looked like what happened to him in real life. So he's definitely pulling from all of these different real life influences from, you know, his many years of life now, even by this point. You know, it's not like Stephen King was super young in the mid to late 2000s.
Yeah. And there's another incident in here that stood out to me that was something that may have happened to someone he knew. That's just kind of sad. And it's how Blaze ended up the way he is. His father beating him and throwing him down the stairs. And a very similar thing happens in Mr. Mercedes. I forget the villain's name in that. But in his backstory, his relationship with his mom, if I'm remembering correctly, his brother falls down the stairs and then it kind of halts his mental development. And he stays about 5 years old mentally until the villain eventually pushes him down the stairs again to kill him. And that was always something when I read Mr. Mercedes that was just kind of, it probably had a lot to do with the fact that I was a new father at the time, but that was just a very like heart-wrenching thing to read. And then coming upon it again in Blaze really made me wonder, oh man, did he know someone who died when he was a kid from a fall down the stairs? It's just these kind of recurrent things. Of course, who knows? He's written so many books over such a long period. These ideas may come back around to him and he doesn't even remember that he used them before.
Yeah. And I mean, when you're known for a specific type of book, and I know that not all King books are the same. I'm not saying that by any means, but he's known for a specific kind of quality with his books, with a few exceptions. Like, there have only been two or three books that I haven't really enjoyed of his, and I am now, I don't know, over 50 books in. So it's not like I'm pulling this from a small sample size. It's just he does have similar ideas, but the way he changes them, I think they're changed just enough for the story to still be interesting.
Yeah, and even when they recur in a different context. Even if the moment is similar, it has a different impact on the story when he brings it back in and reuses it. I mean, I say, you know, like Blaze and Tom Cullen and John Coffey are all this certain type of character, but they're all vastly different, too, with different journeys and different outcomes to what happens. They just have this one thing in common, that they're these large men. Their intelligence hasn't developed past a certain childlike stage. But beyond that, all the choices they make and the kind of people they become, and especially the way they end, is radically different.
Yeah. What do you think of the overall arc of Clay's story in this? Because due to the flashbacks, it's not like we're getting everything in chronological order, which I think is okay. Sometimes that can get a little confusing, but in this instance, because you have this big event that is happening in the present day and something totally different happening in the past, it's easier to keep track of. And I really felt like as soon as Clay took the baby, all of that uncertainty was just building up the entire time, because from what we had already learned about Clay, he didn't seem like the kind of person who could pull something like that off.
Yeah. And it's really kind of amazing he did, due in no small part to the voice of George in his head, which was really him. But when you're getting the backstory of his life and all the things that happened to him as a child and that happened in Hell House, and it's humanizing him as you get these things, and we're coming back to the present. So you're really kind of on his side. You start rooting for him to get out of this and to be able to make some kind of better life for himself. But you also start to see that even though he's not traditionally intelligent, he had a lot of moments when he was a kid where he was, if not clever, at least had like survival instincts, you know, that he knew what to do to keep himself going all the time, even in these horrible situations that he would find himself in. And sometimes those instincts led him to things that were, you know, bad situations, like all the times where he decided it was better to just take a beating, his teacher or from the foster parents he was with, these things, on up to when he and his friend Johnny found a wallet with $200 and something in it and decided to break out of school and go on a vacation to Boston, and, you know, are constantly confronted with these moments where they could get busted, and Johnny talks through them, but Blaze always makes like the right choice of what to do to back up what Johnny's doing. So it's kind of interesting that he's not entirely a dunce, but it does kind of present an interesting narrative quality too, that he can't always make the right choices and can't always think through things, because it allows him to make, just from a writer's standpoint, it allows him to make the decisions he needs to make to get the plot in a certain point. You know, he has to make a mistake in, you know, several areas for the FBI and the state police to end up finding out who he is and where he is, etc. So it's kind of an interesting character to plop down in a book like this, especially when you're talking crime books. Usually the criminal is some kind of, if, you know, if not a genius, like they're brighter than everybody else.
Or at least think they are.
Yeah, or at least think they are. And it becomes one of the interesting things following them. And with Blaze, that trope is very much tipped completely over. And we get the reverse, that, you know, he's just kind of, in many instances, just blundering his way through this caper and somehow staying alive as long as he does.
And the fact that they call it the crime of the century, too, at least in the description on the back of the book, I can't recall if they call it that in the book itself, but I just think that's a very interesting way to frame what this story is about. Because if you read the back of the book first on, you know, the hardcover copy, you go into it thinking that you're going to get this sort of big mastermind crime, and that's very much so not what you get. And I love that it subverts your expectations that way.
Yeah, I completely expected a fast-paced thriller the whole time, with this guy just constantly on the run and trying to stay two steps ahead. And you get a little bit of that, but it's kind of stretched out and plays a lot slower than I expected it to play.
Just looking at what he's written as Richard Bachman too, I think you can sort of see a pattern there, because Thinner is one of the bigger Richard Bachman books. It had a movie adaptation, and I think that story is similar in the sense that it is more thriller-like and sort of crime-driven. Although in Thinner, you have the curse aspect and you have this more supernatural element to it. But I feel like when he writes as Bachman, he writes with a very different intention.
Yeah, that it's very much a different kind of world he's playing in. And it's interesting too, you know, I've seen the film adaptations, but this was the first Bachman book I read. And one of the things I found interesting in this, and I know this was just published recently, but I kind of want to go and read the other Bachman books for several reasons, but to see if this pops up too, is there were a lot of little nods to other Stephen King works in this, which makes me wonder if the other Bachman books have them, because I was like, how did people not recognize this was him for so long? But like Shawshank kept popping up. Anytime they would talk about the big prison, they were talking about Shawshank and little things like that. And a few character names that I recognize from other works. You know, of course, I think the police are the Castle County police. I don't think that's a real county. I think that's his Castle Rock County. So just little things like that. But of course, all that, I don't know, all that could have been changed.
Well, by the time this came out, I think the jig was long up, but because he had written it in the time period when he was writing as Bachman, he just released it under that same name. I mean, my copy has a novel by Richard Bachman, foreword by Stephen King, right on the cover.
Okay. Yeah, I've got a new one. So just a Stephen King writing is Richard Bachman.
Okay. Yeah, I think this hardcover is from around the time when it came out. I don't know if it's a first edition. I am looking real quick here. Yes, this is the first edition hardcover from June 2007 from Scribner. So I imagine that by this point, people knew. So I think it was just a fun little thing to do. Be like, oh, the novel's by Richard Bachman, but the foreword's by Stephen King.
Yeah. And like you said, I think King fans who had read the Bachman books knew the type of book they would get then diving into it. It's interesting. I think in the foreword to the edition I have too, I think he blames Thinner as the one that gave him away. That when people read Thinner, they were like, oh, no, this is Stephen King. So,
yeah, I felt like this was a fun little read, though, because it came not too long after I had finished the Dark Tower series. So it was kind of refreshing to get something different between this and The Colorado Kid, because those two were definitely very different. You know, The Colorado Kid, for anyone who doesn't know, is part of the Hard Case Crime series, which is not something that is in the Stephen King universe by any means. It's its own thing, and different writers do different stories there, so it's not even exclusively a Stephen King thing. So I just liked seeing those differences in stories after finishing, you know, his big, long epic. Well, almost finishing. I still have The Wind Through the Keyhole.
Yeah, I'm such a Dark Tower fan. I think I read through the whole series twice, and then I bought The Wind Through the Keyhole on the day it came out, and it's still sitting on my bookshelf unread for absolutely no reason whatsoever. I really need to rectify that. Yeah, The Hard Case Crime is interesting. I want to check out The Colorado Kid. I kept thinking of Joyland a lot while reading this, which I listened to on a road trip. The audiobook was recorded by, was read by Michael Kelly, the actor who plays Doug Stamper on House of Cards.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's really fun. I haven't gotten to Joyland just yet. It's coming up, I want to say, in a handful of books, but I really like when he does something different. And I know the Mr. Mercedes trilogy is this way too, where it's more crime driven. And I love that even though Stephen King is known as the king of horror, his stories aren't all exclusively horror. Obviously, The Dark Tower is this big fantasy epic, like, you know, so many people have said, and I just said a few minutes ago, but it's nice when you get something that doesn't necessarily feel like a typical Stephen King story still, and Blaze definitely felt along those lines, and that could be because it was a Richard Bachman story instead of a King story, but obviously it's all still him, no matter which way you look at it, and with characters like Clay and George and even the family. I thought the family was very interesting, and we didn't talk about them just yet, but the Gerards, they are super rich. So you have this big juxtaposition between their status and class and Clay. And he doesn't really go in the direction of, oh, I hate these people. And, you know, some people will kidnap a child from a rich family to get a reward, and they know going into it that there's this big class difference, but I don't know if Clay was aware enough to really understand the consequences to what he was doing because this family was rich.
Yeah, he never really thinks about that or dwells on that. George does, and when George speaks to Clay, George does. You know, George constantly rants about Republicans screwing the poor and all this. So like George is definitely aware of that class divide, and it probably plays in some to it. But I never get the sense Blaze is. In fact, you kind of get the sense that he, you know, when he breaks into their house and he sees the photographs and gets scared and punches the great aunt, you know, all this stuff, that he kind of likes the family. You know, he's legitimately sorry, he says to the guy on the phone, when he calls about the ransom, he's legitimately sorry about punching the great aunt and that she ended up passing. So you don't get any kind of sense that he's a class warrior. This was just a plan that George came up with, and he doesn't really know what else to do with his life right now. So he's going to enact this one last thing George did and hope it sets him up for the rest of his life, which is kind of an interesting thing too, especially when we get to toward the end of the book and we get to see the backstory of how he ended up with George and how George died. It's kind of interesting because at the beginning of the book, I got the sense that George had been dead a while. But once you get to that point, it feels more immediate. It feels like George died right before all this started, and that Blaze immediately left from where George was stabbed, climbed in a car, and George appeared in the back seat. And he was like, okay, let's get ready to kidnap this kid.
I just think it's always interesting how sometimes that discrepancy in class will factor into the story a lot, but here it's more in passing, and obviously King is going to get his politics in. And I think, you know, he's been very vocal politically on Twitter and everything, and I'm always confused by the people who get upset by that, because if they read his books, they have to know this comes into play in a lot of his works.
Yeah, I mean, this was written in 1973. And every time George goes on a rant, I mean, there's at least five rants in here where George talks about Republicans screwing the poor. And there's like a Blaze gets the paper at one point, or maybe he turns on the radio news, and there's a Republican politician who's being arrested for taking a bribe. This was always in his work. I think we talked about this when we talked about Salem's Law too, that, you know, a big bulk of his writing was done during and immediately following Nixon and Watergate. And the fingerprints of that are all over his work at the time. Up through, I mean, you know, he has very explicitly political work. I mean, people who are like, oh, Stephen King was never political before. It's, have you read The Dead Zone? Yeah. Like, I don't know how you get more political than that.
And I'm not a person who, you know, spends a lot of time talking about politics on my podcast, but obviously it has come up with this one because it's like, how can it not? Almost. And I honestly don't recall if we dug into the politics too much on the Dead Zone book episode, because that was like one of the first 10 episodes or something. So, you know, that was about 100 episodes ago. My memory is a little hazy on those ones. But, you know, even in something like The Talisman, it comes up and you really can't necessarily ignore it. I mean, sure, I could choose to skip it and not talk about it, but in certain books, it would be taking away a big part of the story.
Yeah, and so many of King's books are about the regular guy, you know, yeah. Just a blue-collar Joe who gets caught up in something way beyond them. And, you know, and if you know anything about his life, and I think in On Writing, he goes a lot into his father leaving when they were at a young age and his mom having to bounce around working all these odd jobs. And then, you know, I think they were living in a trailer and they didn't even have enough money to have a phone hooked up when he sold Carrie. You know, he's not putting on airs. That's his background. And so his sympathies and his worldview are there in each of those characters. You know, you talk about the class divide in this, it's not explicit. Blaze doesn't comment on it.
Right.
But you can't help but notice, once you start getting Blaze's backstory, the trajectory of a child who grew up in poverty versus the children of the Gerards.
Yeah, exactly.
Even when we find out that Blaze had a kid he doesn't know about that got put up for adoption, and that kid got adopted by a wealthy family, and we find out his own son's life trajectory, which was a nice little moment where it was like, oh, something, he doesn't know about it, but something good came from him. He had a kid who went on to have a really good life, but he had a good life because he was adopted by a wealthy family.
Right. You know? You also have the fact that something like this wouldn't be dubbed the crime of the century if it wasn't a rich family's child.
Oh, right, right. If this was a poverty or even a lower middle class family whose child was kidnapped, it wouldn't be all over the news. They wouldn't be putting the family's requests of the kidnapper in the newspaper the way they do. None of that would happen. In fact, you kind of see a little bit, you know, of how the legal system treats children from poverty backgrounds in Blaze's backstory, and they don't care. They just kind of want to shuffle them off and get them out of their way.
I have to admit, I did enjoy this one a lot more than I was expecting, because I've gone into some of these books not knowing what to expect simply because they aren't the books that people talk about a lot. You know, I had heard about all of the big ones, you know, because of the Shining movie, the TV movie, you know, the It TV miniseries and the new adaptations. You know, there are some Stephen King properties that are just so iconic at this point, you can't really not know about them. And I think there are so many of his books that are still very good, but sort of, I don't want to say underrated, but just they're lesser known.
Yeah, it's interesting because with such a library, I mean, he's written so many books. You wonder if it wasn't for The Shinings and It and The Stand, if you took those out and you were left with the rest of his library, would we be talking about these books, or would he be an obscure author that no one talks about? Is it those anchor books that really make King who it is, or is it the kind of the foundational work, the fact that he has these huge cultural touchstone novels, but a solid library of really good books backing them up? Like you said, I mean, you've read more of King at this point than I have, and you've only encountered a couple that you haven't liked.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's a solid writer. Even when, you know, a big criticism of him, especially over his more modern work, is that he often flubs the ending.
Yeah. That's something I've talked about a lot, and I don't think this ending was really controversial in any way. You know, you have times where in Christine, for instance, he has this good ending and then he just kind of adds this little epilogue and you're like, oh, okay. I mean, yeah. I don't know if we really need some of the epilogues he gives us, but you know, Christine by far is not one of the worst endings. And I really love how something like Pet Sematary ends. And he does nail the endings enough to where I'm not like, oh, he just ruins all of his books at the end, you know?
I think he gets the endings more often than he misses them. I think, and this is a good one, I think it ends exactly where it does. And you can feel what's going to happen at the ending about halfway through the book. And I think that's part of it. I mean, it's a tragedy is what you're reading. And so you know probably how this is going to end up, and you hope it doesn't. And especially the more you learn about Blaze, you want to follow him through. But I think some of his more recent books I've read, I feel like he's gotten sentimental as he's gotten older. There are certain books like Dr. Sleep. It felt like the natural ending to that was for Danny to die, even though I love the character and I didn't want him to. But then he kind of like pulls a 180 at the end. He's like, no, he's okay. And I was like, you just lied to me. Yeah. Same thing with Mr. Mercedes. The book makes such a big deal out of your main character having a heart condition. And then he finally has a heart attack when he saves the day. And it's like, oh, he died. And then he's just miraculously back. And he's like, oh, well, you know, my old ticker's working again. And it's like, what? I feel like after 40 years of writing a lot of dark, tragic stuff, that maybe he's looking for a little hope right now.
Yeah, we'll see what comes from him in, you know, future books, because he's never done writing. And I know he actually has another hard case crime book coming this year, and he will probably have something later in the year, I imagine. But Brad, do you have any final thoughts on Blaze? I had fun reading this one. Like I said, it was a nice little break from some of his longer books. I had read this right after reading Lisi's Story, and I have Duma Key coming up now, which is massive, and many more massive books coming soon. So it was kind of just a nice little reprieve for me, honestly.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of how I felt. It was really nice to dive into a book, especially a Stephen King book, that was just so simple and focused, and let you just kind of take this journey and spend some time with this character, as opposed to being introduced to a big epic world and the forces behind reality and 18 characters and a dozen subplots that weave together, you know?
Yeah. Well, thank you again for joining me on this little journey here. It was fun, and I'm looking forward to how these things feel after I've read everything, because I know you said you haven't read quite as much as I have, but I feel like when people are fans of Stephen King, they tend to want to read at least most of it, if not all of it.
Yeah, I find myself doing that. I'm constantly, you know, as a writer, I'm like, all right, I want to read a lot of different authors in a lot of different genres. And about every fifth time I buy a book, I'm like, I think I'm just going to get another Stephen King.
Yeah. As someone who has almost all of them now, I didn't end up buying a copy of Cycle of the Werewolf, but I checked it out from the library. So I don't own that one, but I've read it. And then I think The Outsider is the only one I don't own either in physical copy, which I have almost all of them in physical copies, but I think I have If It Bleeds as an ebook. So, you know, I'll read them however I can get them.
Have you done The Outsider show on your podcast yet?
No, since I'm going chronologically, that'll probably come at the end of the year.
I can't wait to hear what you think about that. I really dug the show. I think it was one of the better adaptations of his work I've seen in a long time.
I did watch it, but I hadn't read the book. So now I'm going to go do it in backwards order, basically.
That was one other interesting thing I'll say about Blaze, too, is reading this, I could very much see this as a kind of a small indie crime film. There were a lot of very cinematic moments without being big and epic, you know, not car chases and whatnot, but kind of the small moments, the character moments with Blaze, especially Blaze and the baby or Blaze and George.
I feel like this could make for a good Sundance entry or something along those lines, because a lot of those indie films, while they typically aren't adaptations, I know some of them have been, and this feels like something you could do on a pretty small budget, because you wouldn't necessarily need the CGI that they used in It Chapter 2 or things like that. It's a very sort of low budget crime film that you could do with this, and it always interests me which ones have not been adapted, because there are certain ones where you're like, yes, I understand why this one has not been adapted. But then they adapt other things and you're just like, why do we have four of these?
Yeah, I mean, the fact they keep going back to adapt It and The Stand, both of which I love, and I can't wait to watch the new Stand series. I haven't seen it yet. But those are such huge, epic, sprawling stories when so much of what he writes is this very tight, contained work that's obviously been influenced by the movies. That was one of my, I thought one of the big places where they dropped the ball with the Dark Tower movie. I mean, there were a lot of places they dropped the ball with the Dark Tower movie, but when you go back and you read The Gunslinger, it reads like a film. You could adapt that book basically page for page, and you would have a very tight, fun, cool movie with a lot of interesting action set pieces. And the fact that they threw it out to come up with their own story that they did is just really mind-boggling. Like, I always understand when you're doing an adaptation that there's different needs for different mediums, but when the work you're adapting has already done it well and you make choices that are worse, it's really a head-scratcher.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see in the coming years what ends up being adapted that maybe hasn't been just yet, because I know there's always stuff in the works and you never really know what's going to happen and what's not.
Yeah, or how it will happen. I was just reading, I think it was Revival, has been through two directors, and for whatever reason, they can't get the studio to sign off on what they want to do. So it's like, will Revival ever see the light of day? Who knows? And he has so many short stories, and you never know which one of those are getting adapted. I'd seen something, I think somebody's adapting The Jaunt, which is from Skeleton Crew, this very cool kind of sci-fi horror idea. That's just a very small, tight little story, but the fact that somebody's like, no, that's the one I want to do. I'm not going to do any of his bigger novels. I want to direct that short story. You know, it's really interesting. So you never know what you're going to get. I think a lot of the best movies that have been based on his work have been based on short stories.
Yeah, short stories or novellas. You know, I really love Shawshank and The Body being adapted into Stand By Me. I think those work really well, especially the length of a novella compared to the length of a script. It tends to be very close in range. So I think those translate well as long as the story is something that would work well on the screen. And, you know, Brad, I know the spreadsheet for everything coming up is a little crazy here, but like I said, I still have some stuff to add. So hopefully you'll be back on the podcast again soon.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, if you've got anything you're trying to fill out, feel free to throw me on it. I'm always down to talk about Bab King, and I have fun every time I talk to you, and it makes me think of the work in a different way. So please, anytime you want to have me back on, I am available.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.